from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Universal Pictures is pulling the plug on its movie where jet-setting elites hunt other people for sport. Then we wade through massive crowds at Outside Lands in San Francisco. We'll hear from organizer Alan Scott about Outside Lands becoming the first major music festival to sell marijuana.
Everyone talks about San Francisco being the best city or one of the best food cities in the world. Let's celebrate that. The natural evolution next was cannabis.
And Outside Lands is where Australia's Alex Leahy kicked off her U.S. tour.
Pretty surreal. Like, it's definitely a baptism of fire.
All that coming up on The Frame. The Hunt was supposed to arrive in theaters next month, but now it's unclear when or if the movie about killing people for sport will see the light of day. Over the weekend, Universal Pictures announced it was canceling the film's release. The decision comes in the wake of mass shootings in California, Texas, and Ohio. And while few outside of Universal have seen The Hunt, it was criticized for an apparent line in its script where the victims of The Hunt are referred to as deplorables, Hillary Clinton's term for Trump supporters.
Every year, a bunch of elites kidnap normal folk like us. Where'd they get you from?
Wyoming.
Mississippi.
Orlando. And hunt us for sport.
Tatiana Siegel is the deputy film editor at The Hollywood Reporter, and she began by telling me how the shootings affected the film's release.
The mass shootings happened on a Saturday and Sunday, approximately 9 days ago, I believe. And during that same weekend, ESPN pulled their advertisement for the film. Then Universal executives started discussing amongst themselves whether it was advisable to move forward with this film. They landed on yes, and they were going to continue discussing how to market it. Then the Hollywood Reporter story that I wrote broke, and I am told that there was more pressure put on.
It does feel as though a lot of people are assuming that in this movie, certain things happen that may not. So how much is known about the plot? Have people actually seen the movie outside of Universal and Blumhouse?
I don't believe so. And I think that the number of people who have even read the script is pretty small. And I'm part of that group. I would say that they kept it very much under lock and key for the past 18 months since it was first shopped. And I actually remember very clearly being very intrigued by this back 18 months ago when I was reporting on it and started asking other studios if they were interested in it at the time. And I was told by everybody I asked wouldn't touch it.
I would say there have been a lot of very similar movies before about people either being hunted for sport or as a major plot point. I'm thinking the 1932 film, The Most Dangerous Game, 1972's Deliverance, the Hunger Games movies, and even the Purge films, which were made by the same production company and studio. So why did The Hunt get targeted, do you think?
Even though it harkens to Hunger Games and there is that sort of, you know, group of people stuck in a situation they're not familiar with and are being hunted down, it actually reminded me in some ways more of The Interview because it's a satire and a lot of the humor is, you know, it's going to maybe work on screen, but I would say that most of the outrage that is going to be directed at this film will be via people who've never seen the film. And that's how it goes for any film these days. You know, they read a snippet of dialogue on social media. And so The Interview was more similar in a sense because it had an ability to anger or incite a person or a group of people or the North Korean government, in that case, the way this could incite or make angry a certain group of people or two groups of people, depending upon, you know, who feels satirized by this material.
Yeah, we should say that Sony pulled The Interview and it was also a comedy, a spoof about the assassination of Kim Jong-un. And it may have had something very directly to do with the hack of Sony Pictures. So we should say that there have been times in the past where movies have been edited after things that have happened in real life. Certainly some films were either delayed or re-edited after 9/11. Back in 2012, the movie Gangster Squad was recut following the shootings in the theater in Aurora, Colorado. Did Universal contemplate editing it, or was it always a question of yes or no, that they either had to release the film or pull it?
they have to decide whether they can release this film at all. And if so, can we do some editing that will make this more palatable and, you know, be able to put this into the marketplace and still not lose its satirical edge? The question is whether there will ever be a time where there's not a mass shooting in the United States that happens to be, you know, closely corresponding with a film's release. Now, there also is the fact that there are lots of guns in this movie. Now, that's not terribly uncommon, but I think that we never have been in a time where the nation seemed as polarized. And, you know, there are instances where people are acting violently on that polarization. So I think that's what's unique right now. And don't forget, this movie was previously titled Red State versus Blue State.
There's been a lot of conversation about the phrase deplorables. I haven't seen it in the most recent trailer. Did it turn up in some creative marketing materials for the film?
It turned up in a story that I wrote with Kim Masters for The Hollywood Reporter, because we used dialogue that was used in the film. So they were very careful in how they were marketing it. However, they were airing these ads and they were marketing it on things like the Democratic debates and Fox News. So they were playing into the red state versus blue state kind of animus, if you will.
Is Universal concerned that there might be a backlash from the creative community, that if the studio isn't willing to take on material that may be polarizing and may be divisive and may actually be kind of morally questionable, that other filmmakers could go places where they are welcome? Is that part of the calculation or potential backlash?
I think that's an important point, and it is probably being discussed internally at Universal, whether this sends a negative message, but it's something that studios always have to consider when something could be potentially incendiary. And this is not the first movie that would fall into that category. So there is a fine line that studios have to walk between, you know, supporting filmmaking and supporting important voices.
Tatiana Siegel is the deputy film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Tatiana, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Anytime. Thanks, John.
Coming up on The Frame, we leave Pasadena for San Francisco and its Outside Lands Music Festival. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. This is America. Over the weekend, Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett and I traveled to San Francisco. More specifically, we were visiting the city's Golden Gate Park, which is the home of the Outside Lands Music Festival.
I gotta carry on.
And it's where Childish Gambino, the musical alter ego of actor Donald Glover, played to a crowd approaching 90,000 people.
Hard time out here right now. I want you guys to know that I love you and you guys should love yourself.
San Francisco's Outside Lands is relatively new. It started in 2008, but it quickly is gaining a national reputation, not only for its eclectic music lineup, but also for its high-end food, wine, and new this year to any major American festival, a sort of farmer's market for marijuana. Like other festivals, there are a lot of younger and less famous acts, some of whom had traveled many miles to get to Outside Lands. Yesterday, Jonathan and I met with Alex Leahy. She's from Australia. She was just starting her North American tour. Her latest record is called The Best of Luck Club, and her songs touch on everyday bar life to marriage equality. Australia only recently legalized gay marriage. Here's what inspired her latest album.
When I finished my first record, I sort of started writing songs. You know, when I had time, I would write a song. And I was sort of struggling to find a place where they kind of belonged. And then when I finished touring in the middle of last year, I spent a little bit of time in Nashville and sort of found myself really connecting with, like, the bar scene over there. You know, East Nashville bars are some of the best. The part about it that I like the most is that it's just, like, anyone can go. And it made me think about, like, how people just aren't really that different. Like, despite the way that we all present or, like, whatever stage we are at in life or the way we feel at a given time, like, we're actually all not that different, and that's actually a really beautiful thing. And the most beautiful part about it is that it means that by default we all understand each other, And that's why it's really important for us to be kind to each other and to empathize and to listen and support one another. And that's kind of like the ethos of the Best of Luck Club.
Remember when you and I would go all night, start drinking at 8 and work through the alphabet. Now all this time has gone by.
Where are you on your tour? How far along? How far in?
This is actually the first show.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so first show of the North American leg of this record, you know, which is pretty cool.
Thank you guys so much. How are you? My name's Alex Leahy. I'm from Melbourne, Australia. Outside Lands, baby, we made it. This is it. I'm retiring.
When you think about playing any show, you know, if you're playing a small club, probably a fair amount of the people who are coming know your music. If you're playing a festival like this, you might get people who are kind of stumbling upon you. Mm-hmm. What do you hope comes out of it? Do you hope people discover your music, that you have a new connection with an audience? What are the goals, if they're definable?
I mean, I think that, like, you know, my whole thing is that, like, I want to be doing this for the rest of my life. And so, like, I want people to come along with me, you know, like, let's do it together. And, like, finding people who really connect with the music in a way that it, like, you know, sort of is a small part of the fabric of their lives and they can hold that with them, I think is like a really beautiful thing to be a part of. I feel like this happens in America, like people will keep coming back. It's like, you know, I've seen you like 5 times. I'm like, why? But like they keep coming, and it's awesome, and that's why I keep coming back, and that's what keeps me fulfilled and happy and makes my job more meaningful.
Alex, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
On the same stage where Alex Leahy performed, kind of squeezed between two big venues where some of the headliners play, was another band that had just wrapped up its North American tour. Alton Gun is based in Amsterdam, but they play traditional music from Turkey, in Turkish. When we caught up backstage, they were packing up their instruments, some of which they were about to sell before heading back to Europe. I spoke with their bassist, Jasper Verholst, and their lead singer, Merva Desmadir, about how they measure a crowd.
Yeah, I observe a lot. I observe the crowd. Yeah, usually it's easy for me to guess if there's any Turkish people and stuff, and how they react, and how they sort of interact with non-Turkish people in the crowd who are just there for the music. It's really cool, yeah.
I want to ask you, Jasper, about how this band came together, mm-hmm. What the inspiration was, and how the band has grown and evolved. So what was the first inspiration behind its formation?
Well, the inspiration was the whole Turkish 70s folk rock scene, basically. It was a very popular genre in Turkey in the 70s, like just taking traditionals and standards and giving them like a psychedelic rock treatment. And that's exactly what we're doing now also, kind of. So we're kind of reviving that whole Turkish folk rock scene from the 70s in a way.
How did the band come together? I understand there was like a Facebook post looking for some information, is that right?
Definitely, yeah. And the first two people that responded are the people that you saw today, so.
What are the folk songs about? Are they about people's feelings? Are they about loss, tragedy? Is there a theme of the songs that you're attracted to?
Yeah, mostly all those things you just said, plus like a lot of questioning. It's just words of wisdom about life.
Yeah. And it's all very poetic, right?
It's
really hard
poetic.
To translate.
It's like, extremely poetic.
We sometimes I don't speak Turkish. Yeah. Only two people in the band speak Turkish. But if we ask, like, what does this mean, like, it's always really hard to translate.
So, Jasper, you play these songs, and even you don't know what they're about?
True, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, now it's Turkish we're talking about, but, you know, I'm sure everybody here is listening to also Brazilian music or, you know, yeah, Spanish.
African,
anything.
You
and,
don't get
you know,
a word of that
does
too,
the like does the lyrics matter then when we're listening to those, for instance? You know, I think it's just music, just those frequencies of sounds, they transcend. I mean, you know, Turkey is not always the best topic anywhere in the world, so it's nice to bring something positive about it. It makes me, like, because born and raised in some, I'm sort of, it makes me a little proud, you know?
What is it like to find songs? Because if you're doing traditional folk songs,
Are there still a lot of good songs out there that you haven't explored and haven't wrestled with?
I think it's endless.
So many. It's like endless. It's
there is that great a Turkish folk tradition that you can just go forever.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Tell me how you pronounce the name of the band.
Altın Gün.
Thank you guys so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Outside Lands also has cooking demonstrations. The singer Ella Mai tried to make calamari in front of hundreds of fans. And there's comedy as well. One of the comedians was Dulce Sloan. She's a correspondent on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. And we talked about playing to a crowd that's largely white and very privileged.
I have an easier time talking about race in front of Southern white people than anybody else.
Why is that?
The South is the only place that has had to be reprimanded and reconciled with racism. Because of Jim Crow, because of segregation, because it was on the books. Now, mind you, Jim Crow and segregation were nationwide. But the South is the only place to put signs up and was real intense about it. Some of those racist stuff that's ever happened to me in LA. I think the South is one of the few places that will openly talk about race relations. It's interesting because people always want to act like the South is the only place that racism existed. Which is very confusing for me.
You've said about your comedy that it's social and not political. How would you define the difference between the two?
I'm only talking about me and my experiences in the world. But every time I get on stage, it can be seen as a political act. I did have like a Trump joke, like when he first got elected, but it was in relation to how my friend reacted to it. My straight white guy friend called me crying that Trump got elected. I'm like, why are you on my phone? You're fine. I got two lesbians on hold. What do you need? It was so funny that like all of these white women in their brain, it just clicked. And it was like, oh, I'm oppressed. Well, shit. And then now y'all are marching on Washington. But I'm like, where y'all been? And all of a sudden you put these little cute hats on and now y'all want to march on a city. But if y'all had been working the whole time, maybe he wouldn't even got elected.
You do a show, people are laughing, they're having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Is it as important to you, even if you can't measure it, that they've been challenged, they've thought about something in a new way? There are people in San Francisco who say, I voted for Obama, I'm not racist, where you are actually challenging people and their beliefs. Can you measure that, and do you try to do it?
No. My whole point is for you to come in here and laugh. Because some crowds, it's some nights is how I feel. Because I know when I go that route, I also have to bring them back out of it. Because some crowds, it's just like, oh, y'all are too drunk for a message. Let me talk about titties till y'all leave. Like, I can't. Yeah, dicks are great. Like, I can't go there with certain crowds certain times. I'm not one of those comics that writes a joke to prove a point. I write a joke about what affects me, and it can end up proving a point. I had to process in my brain police brutality. But I also had to process in my brain that people don't talk about black women getting killed by the police. So how do I process that information? And then other times, there's things that I don't talk about that are happening because there are other comics who are saying it better.
Dulce Sloan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Yay, we did it.
Coming up, more of our postcard from Outside Lands in San Francisco. Let's continue now with some of the other things that happen at Outside Lands, which attracted more than 200,000 people in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park from Friday to Sunday. There's Wine Lands, which is exactly what you think it is. Also, dozens of high-end food stands, where you can get items like a fried chicken sandwich from Sorrel, a Michelin-starred restaurant. And Grasslands, which was touted as the first major U.S. music festival with on-site cannabis sales. Nug is a vendor inside Grasslands. It was one of the more than two dozen cannabis distributors who were set up inside an area that looks kind of like a Western town crossed with a farmer's market.
I'm Tyler Cook. I'm the Edibles Department Director for Nug.
I am Jason Guillory. I'm the Marketing Director at Nug. We actually, our sales director came from the craft brew industry. So I see a lot of people moving from tech, from craft beer into the cannabis space as it becomes more serious and as it becomes more of a legitimate business. You know, our goal is to normalize the cannabis experience. And through products like these, we're getting ever closer. We want it to be okay in a hospital for a chemo patient to be like, yeah, I need a cannabis popsicle.
And as far as like off the wall things that I've created that are on the docket to launch, I've done everything from a do-it-yourself at home macaroni and cheese in a box, pixie sticks. We have an Otterpot product that's coming out that I'm really excited about. It's going to be something you can enjoy. They're refreshing. It's something that will be perfect for next year's Outside Land.
If your drug of choice comes in a bottle, there's Winelands, where dozens of wineries poured Cabernets, Zinfandels, and many more varietals. It's all curated by Peter Eastlake. He's a sommelier and a music fan, and he said he approaches wine the way a promoter might put together a music lineup.
I like to think about, you know, the crowd and, you know, the time of the day. And, you know, I have anything from tropical Moscato to obviously tons of rosé to, you know, concrete egg fermented Aligoté where they made 80 cases. So I've got it all in here. And that's why I have 46 wineries. And you'll see as the day goes on, there's a line at every single station. So the crowd reflects, you know, all the different styles of wine that are out there.
So it's a little drizzly. It's a great kind of West San Francisco afternoon.
Sure.
I'm thinking like a fruity red. What are you thinking? I mean, you're the sommelier. Where would you take me if I come to you and say, surprise me? Where should we go?
I would love to have you taste. There's a Gamay that's made by a winery called Gros Ventre. And it's, you know, Gamay is a grape that you only find in Beaujolais, France. And very few winemakers outside of Beaujolais actually can make it like that. And this is one of those wines.
So I have my reusable Outside Lands, I don't know, is it aluminum? What is this thing made of?
Steel.
Steel wine glass.
Let's do it. Let's stick some Gamay in it.
Okay, we're going to stick some Gamay in here.
So
that's really good. Where is this?
Kevin.
Californian?
Kevin, tell us about this.
This is actually a wine from Gros Ventre. This is a Gamay Noir from grapes grown in El Dorado.
We actually have two Gamay. We have Arnett Roberts Gamay as well, which is another pretty darn good producer and another great expression of Gamay from
California.
Just
put the Gamay guys away from each other so there's not like a Gamay fight. It's like East Coast, West Coast. You don't want to have that kind of battle.
50 yards between them.
Peter Eastlake is the curator of Winelands. Peter, thanks for the tour and thanks for the wine.
Thanks so much. Really fun to have you here.
Outside Lands is put together by Berkeley's Another Planet Entertainment, Superfly from New Orleans, and Virginia's Star Hill. Alan Scott is with Another Planet, and I met him backstage just after one of the best acts at Outside Lands had wrapped up her set.
Everybody's gonna have to give some time.
I just saw Mavis Staples do almost an hour. I don't think she sat down. She's 80 years old. When you book somebody like Mavis Staples, do you know what you're going to get? Are you out there watching to see how it turns out?
Yeah, I feel so fortunate with how we are allowed to program this festival, because the Bay Area, San Francisco, it's just such a wide range of ages and musical tastes here, and it gives us a lot of freedom to book, so we don't have to just book the most current, trendy, top of the Spotify charts artists. We can really go deep, and I think people really appreciate that.
How would you say the non-musical aspects to the festival distinguish it? What are you guys doing that other festivals either aren't or haven't yet started doing?
With the more and more festivals proliferating around the country, it's harder to stand out with your lineup and draw the type of numbers that we want to do. We want to celebrate everything, or a lot of the things, that make San Francisco culture great. We said, look, everyone talks about San Francisco being the best city or one of the best food cities in the world. Let's celebrate that. The natural evolution next was cannabis. That is something that has been on our eye for several years as we saw the trend moving towards legalization in California. And last year, we took the first step with Grasslands as an educational area where people could come in. There was a smell wall. And this year, we applied the permit and fortunately got the state to sign off on Wednesday at 4 o'clock. And here we are. And everyone's been acting responsibly. And it's not, you know, what was the movie in the 20s? Reefer Madness, you know, in there. Everyone, it's been really peaceful and great.
So many people come to a music festival to leave everything that they're worrying about behind. But this festival is happening a week after mass shootings in Ohio and Texas. How do you make sure that all of your guests are safe and yet they don't feel like this is a police state?
And we say that safety is our number one priority. That's our number one priority. That is it. Next, have a great time. And so we try to put all of our security measures in place so that when you get in here, you can let all that stuff go and feel safe and secure and ultimately have a great time.
Alan, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, John.
And that's all for today and all from Outside Lands. I'm John Horn. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.
Yesterday I had nothing. Didn't know whether I'd amount to something. I had holes in my shoes and in my clothes.